This podcast is sponsored by Inspiration Knits. Inspiration Knits patterns are designed to showcase the gorgeous colours and special yarns.
Designer Louise Zass-Bangham creates flexible patterns so you can use hand-dyed yarns, those irresistible impulse buys, and the beauties that have been waiting in your stash for the right pattern to come along.
Louise's patterns have a reputation for being clearly written and a pleasure to knit.
Check out Louise's modern accessory designs at inspirationknits.com. Hello! And welcome to Pomcast, the podcast brought to you by Pom Pom Quarterly. I'm Lydia Gluck, and here I am, as I am once a month, with the lovely Sophie Scott.
Hooray! Hooray! A new month!
Or rather, the end of one month. Goodbye, April. It's been fun.
We hope your April's been fun as well. So, this podcast, as usual, we have Tell and Tell, where we tell you guys and each other about our knits. We've got a top tip. This is a knitting based podcast, so we like to keep those needle tips sharpened.
We do. We'll have our news and reviews and an interview.
This podcast is with Rachel Atkinson, who is part of the Pom Pom crew for many a year. Fabulous knitter and tech editor.
She certainly is. And now, producer of fabulous yarn.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk to her about all those many hats she wears and whether they're all hand knitted or not.
I'm sure they are.
Hard-hitting journalism from the Pom Pom team.
We've also got knitters you should know about, our little fact-based section. Good to have the facts in there.
And the distinctly unfact-based section, which is top three. But of course you will have to wait till the end of the episode to find out what exactly we'll be listing.
I can't wait.
Oh boy!
We've got to start this podcast with, of course, the things you need to know on a knit-to-know basis. That's the new pun that we have for this section now, which I was very pleased with.
And I was very pleased that Sophie came up with this, and she is
working away. Wait a minute, Lydia, what about this? Genius, right?
I love it, I can see it in lights. So on a knit-to-know basis, what have we got for the people?
What have you been up to? That's basically what we're asking.
Yeah. I recently had a birthday.
Hooray!
I am now...
Happy birthday!
Thank you.
I've said that already. Come on. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, Sophie was very punctual with her birthday wishes. She didn't wait till this recording to tell me that she was pleased that I was still alive. It was good. Yes, I had a nice day, and I am now a year older, a year closer to 30, going to be 30 next year.
Wow.
I'm excited about it.
Good for you.
I think it's going to be good. And I'm also excited for the year leading up to it. You know, I don't just want to skip to 30.
No.
I'm into the time between now and then. I also went and saw the new Disney Jungle Book.
Hey, how was that?
It was great. It was punctuated by some slightly, well, very British events. So we went to see it for a friend's birthday in the daytime, sort of late afternoon showing in 3D. We were all very excited. We got there, got our popcorn, got a bottle of wine.
Wow.
Don't worry, guys, I'm almost 30, it's fine. So we got this bottle of wine, we were all excited, went into the theatre, had our 3D glasses ready. We were watching the film. My glasses aren't working.
What was happening?
Looked around and everybody was doing the same and looking at their glasses. Oh my God, glasses aren't working. A member of staff came in, turned the film off. This is about 15 minutes into the film as well, so everybody was getting... There were lots of people sort of running up and down the aisles, going to ask for help, you know. But everybody was like, oh, it must be me. And then they had to turn it off and apologise, and we had to wait for the projector to reset. And in the meantime, because of course it was mostly kids and their parents watching this film, kids were just running around, which I thought was brilliant.
Like and a then, wild jungle child.
Exactly. I was like, this is good. These people are exactly the sort of people.
Setting the scene.
Yeah. Anyway, we ended up watching it in 2D, which didn't diminish my enjoyment at all. And I would highly recommend it, especially if you are a fan of the original Jungle Book, which I am. There were little nods to the original. It's not quite the same. Not all of the songs are in it, for example.
What?
Bits of songs. But there are some cool voices.
Do they have the... birds that kind of are like the Beatles?
They do in a way.
Oh gosh,
there's like nods to it, you know.
Okay, good.
But I thoroughly, because I was going because somebody else wanted to for their birthday, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. So that's like my main two things that have happened this month.
Nice, enjoyable things. I'm going with things that I'm enjoying.
Good. Yeah. Tell us more.
On a knit to know basis, I'm obsessed with this new game you can get on your iPhone called, I don't know about the pronunciation, called Neko Asumi. Atsumi. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, did you ever have a Tamagotchi?
Did I?
Well, there you go. It's kind of like that, where you have a little character, but it's like less commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a little garden, and you can put out toys and food, and then tiny digital cats come and visit you.
I think you've definitely showed me this game.
I've shown a lot of people this game. Fiona Alice, who we spoke to on this podcast and who we are good friends with, I kept saying to her, like, no, you really need to get this game. And she's like, oh, okay. You know when you're saying to someone, like, no, it's really good. You definitely need to get it. And she did. And now we're both kind of collect all the different cats. There's, like, special cats that arrive, like Chairman Meow.
Oh, he's my favourite.
Yeah, and there's, like, Mr. Meowgi, like... Little Sansei kind of.
So basically what you're saying is you like a game that has cats and puns.
Oh my gosh, yes, that's why it works. So I'm enjoying that a lot. That's dedicating quite a lot of my time. Also, on a slightly more highbrow way, there's a new Instagram account I'm really enjoying, which I think you, and I'm saying you as in the collective podcast enjoyment.
The podcasts.
The podcasts, mm-hmm. And Lydia.
Yes,
I'm called Gage Review.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember how I found it, but basically it's like a collection of maybe scenes from films or paintings, mm-hmm. or magazine adverts and things like that, all relating to knitting, some of them weaving, majority of them knitting based content.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be maybe the scene from Lost in Translation. She's actually knitting a scarf in that. And some of them are ones that I recognise, and that's nice. And then there's completely off-the-wall films, which, you know, I've never heard of,
mm-hmm.
or seen. And it's interesting to see the little hints of knitwear within these.
Ooh.
And then it kind of makes me want to go and find all these films. So they also have a Tumblr, which I found out recently. But I just kind of really like that little interesting kind of popping up in my feed every now and again.
That's a sort of good way to... come across films that you maybe wouldn't have
exactly, yeah.
normally come across. It's sort of like a pub crawl, but a film crawl,
yeah.
but only things that have knitting in them.
Yeah, so that's very cool. Gage Review, that's my thing to you need to know. This is, it's a mixed cultural bag, this podcast. We'll weave the story of all these different places and events for your interest.
Exactly.
Move on to the next one then. So, tell and tell, where we tell each other, and you guys, what we've been knitting. And what have you been knitting, Lydia?
I've been knitting a perpendicular shawl.
Oh.
From the spring issue.
Very good.
Which I just sort of, because it's 350 gram skeins required for the pattern. And I had a skein of the Pearl Soho line weight that I bought in New York last summer, which is almost 500 yards in a skein. And I just sort of decided that that was probably enough.
Sometimes you just got to go with your gut on these things. Like,
that's probably fine. It's not fine. Well, it's fine, obviously, as in...
It's very fine. Still... It's very thin yarn, yes.
Exactly.
Hey, good point. Hey.
So I have mostly finished that. I've just got a kind of end bit. But basically, I've got another skein of line weight in a different colour that I'm going to finish it off with. And it's going to sort of look like one of the tips has been dipped in paint.
That sounds nice.
So I was just thinking about it like that. Like it'll just... Because I thought about striping one of the sides. But it was just before I was going away. And my tiny brain couldn't decide on a colour combination, basically. I just was like... going through all of my stash, and I, you know, four ply is something that I think probably most knitters have an abundance of, so I was sort of going through all these different four ply. Yes, me and Sophie both just sort of looked at the pile of yarn.
Yeah, we're in Lydia's room and we're like, oh, look at all that yarn. Yeah.
So I just, you know, after hours of looking at different color combinations, I was just like, never mind, I'll just knit it in this color. But now I'm actually quite pleased about my inadvertent design decision.
So what are the colors like? What combo have you gone for?
So what I've got is a colour called Peacock, which is a very pretty kind of dark teal.
Mm-hmm.
Not a navy, but that sort of tone. Like, it's quite dark blue, okay. but not, like, you know, but peacock. Greeny. Much like a peacock's
interesting,
feathers.
Interesting.
It's almost like they named it to evoke the colour, those guys. And then the other colour is a very sort of acidy, yellowy green, which I can't remember the name of. But yeah, I think together they'll be fun.
Yeah.
So that's a thing. How about you?
Nice. I've been quite dedicated, monogamous even, which we were talking about,
mm-hmm.
about how to stay motivated. I'm working on the Terra Shawl, which is a Brooklyn Tweed pattern. Just chugging along with that very nicely. And also Garland, which I've been doing for many a month. But still, that's going well. I think because it's a lot of stocking stitch with that. I think I've got a nice balance now because the Terra has a little bit of lace. And then the Garland's just plain stocking stitch. So I'm able to kind of keep a bit of interest, but kind of something to chug along with. So I've found a nice balance with that.
Good.
And I've been kind of reorganizing stash at the moment. I've decided summer projects is going to be socks. I'm going to have a summer of socks. I'm going to have
lots SOS.
Little portable projects. You know, I've got quite a nice little collection of sock yarn I want to do some fun things with. I've also started appreciating my hand knit socks much more. I've been like really enjoying wearing them. So that's my plans for the summer.
Awesome. Well, and I've all just finished making my right angle top, which I haven't actually worn yet.
Oh wait, you said you'd finish this by the time we spoke on air.
And I know, and I did it. I spent like hours and hours seaming it, and it's so rare that I make something that has so many seams. You know, I like the way seamed things look, and I like the vintagey shape of that top. It's one of the very appealing things about it, and you can't get that shape without having seams. I think it really, and the structure of it is due to this, you know, we know this as knitters, that knitting things seamlessly is awesome and cool. Knitting things with seams, also awesome and cool. It's just that when you think you've finished, you have those...
You've only just started,
exactly. So I spent a few hours seaming, but very enjoyable hours whilst listening to many podcasts. And just finished the neck band. So what I need to do now is the final sort of steam block, kind of, and then the big reveal where I try it on.
Do you need to do it with like a little protractor so you make sure you get all the right angles, definite on that garment?
Do I?
Something like that, yeah.
That's why I haven't finished it.
Right, so there we go.
Need to dig out the protractor. So to our tip-top top tip section, where we share top tips with each other, and also we get you go. We crowdsource the top tips because... I mean, why not? We've got all the podcast's brains as well as our own.
Who's going to know more about knitting than knitters? So just to revisit some of the things we talked about last podcast, and maybe even a podcast before that, we were talking about motivation. And interestingly enough, one of the podcasts, Rachel Lili? Lili? We're calling you that. That's your Rav name now.
RLL.
Yes. She gave us a great tip about being monogamous to her projects. Like, yes, just choose the one. Focus on that. You've got to plod through it. It'll take time. But yes, have a good and wholesome way. And I thought it was quite funny. She came onto the forums to admit that she'd actually failed in her monogamous ways. And she's like, oh, I actually finished a mini project, which I was doing in between her right angle that she was doing. And so she cast on something new. So, I mean, what does that say for the...
She was the leader of the monogamy gang. She's let us all down. No, not really, Rachel. We're just glad that you're...
Well, she's cast on a mountain moss shawl, which is a very lovely pom-pom project. So, I mean, if you're going to break your monogamy, what better way to do it?
Keep it in the family? Should I finish that sentence? Anyway. and we also have...
These metaphors are going too far.
Getting too sexy. and we also have... Sophie had talked previously in another tip-top top tip section about ways of remembering the difference between make one left and make one right. And we had a little tip from Diana Waller, which she thinks she got from Stephen West, so the plot thickens, which is a little kind of sentence, which I will read out. I left the front door open. I'll be right back. So tell us, unpack that for us.
So I was saying to remember, make one right, you think right back, because those words just make sense to me together.
Like, I'll be right back.
I'll be right back. So the needle goes to the back and then it's, you know, you're picking it up like that and you're making a right-leaning increase. But Diana Waller's got a whole little sentence which makes much more sense. So yeah, I left the front door open. So front, left the front and I'll be right back.
So it's just like an easy way to remember that when you're making one left, the needle goes in from the front. And when you're making one right, back.
People, when I've talked to people about doing a knitting podcast, and they're like, how do you explain how to knit in a podcast? And I was like, no, 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 it's not about that. But now I realise we are getting to that point where explaining how to knit without a visual, just through your ears. So we recommend picking up a pair of needles and having a go and putting these words together with an action. I think it would make a lot more sense.
That's true. That's true. But what is our, we've got a very quicken, we've got a less philosophical top tip this week.
I thought this was a standard thing. And when I mentioned it to Lydia, she's like, no, that's cool. So if you have metal needles, and sometimes they just get a little bit sticky, mm-hmm. not that you've been eating sweeties while you've been knitting. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you
that's
have.
Why mine gets sticky.
Lydia, yeah. just kind of just the natural grease on your hands, mm-hmm. I suppose. If you run them through your hair, it kind of stops them getting so sticky. So, like, just, along your scalp, it's actually quite pleasant, you know?
Like, as if you're sort of scratching your head.
Kind of, but yeah.
Don't actually do
it. Don't know. Be careful, guys. But yeah, that kind of, like, takes off some of the residue, I guess. what a delicious way of explaining this. Well, my granny always used to do that. I think she had the very long metal needle. She just, like, whizzed them through her, you know,
blue rinse. Do you think the stickiness comes from your hands or from the wool?
I always thought it was your hands, just naturally. You have, like, oils just naturally on your hands. But then
is that different oil from head oil?
Yeah, well, I thought it's because your hair, in theory, if your hair is really greasy, like, maybe wait a day. But it's just, yeah, I think just the kind of the natural dryness of your hair, I suppose. It just kind of takes off some of the staticky.
That's good to know.
Try it, guys.
Yeah.
And any other top tips? We'd always love to hear them. So this is a good point to remind you guys that we have a Ravelry forum on the Pom Pom group. And also we have an email address, which is podcast@pompommag.com.
It is. So you can send us, I don't know, any sort of suggestions you have or like, so top tips, for example, mm-hmm. anything you'd like to share, or maybe if you'd like to augment our top tips, or if you think our tips aren't top enough, that's fine too. But also, we like getting fun fan mail style things.
We got one of these. This is a good segue.
Yeah, this is. So this is from a few months ago as well, and I kept meaning to mention it and kept forgetting. So apologies to Jennifer O'Brien, but thanks also to Jennifer O'Brien, who sent us a picture of her listening to the podcast. So it was a nice little picture of her listening, and she lives in Victoria, Australia, and you can see a little bit of where she lives in the mountains in rural Australia there, which is fun to imagine, and not even have to imagine, to be able to see a picture of somebody listening to us all the way on the other side of the world where everything's upside down.
And back to front. So yeah, thank you for that. It was really nice. And if you ever miss anything on the podcast or you want to find out more information, we have a blog post on the Pom Pom website. We always update that with more info and links, and sometimes there's fun photos. So you can always check out there. And often we also have a giveaway that links into the podcast.
We certainly do. And this month, I keep wanting to say week. We never do a weekly podcast. This month we have a brilliant giveaway from the lovely Louise of Inspiration Knits, who is sponsoring this podcast. So if you're listening within a certain time frame, within the first couple of weeks that this podcast is released, you can go and check that out. We've got a giveaway of her brilliant book, Knit, Play, Colour.
Yes, that's one of her most recent releases, sort of late last year. It's a collection of shawls, cowls, patterns, you know, your usual beautiful selection
lovely
of patterns.
Lovely accessories.
It's got 10, as a pattern book on its own, you've got mm-hmm. 10 fantastic designs. Within this book, there are options to play with each design, so sort of make it your own.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. So it's sort of like a guided, you know, because I guess you always kind of have that option, but maybe it's always nice to know, or to get tips from the designer, like which bits they think are most flexible within their design. And especially if you haven't done much, you know, if you've always pretty much stuck to the pattern, but you would like to do a bit of exploring, this is a good way to start doing that, but without kind of just going out on your own, just wandering off into the desert of knitting without any water of help.
So yes, she'll provide you with some swatches for shade.
Yes.
So yeah, Louise has a little examples of swatches and some samples, and it takes you through the process of maybe just even the starting points, choosing a different colour.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also options to change the size, maybe play around with the different yarn gauge that you might use. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so all sorts of stuff. So if you are listening to this in time, or even if you're not, go and check out the show notes, but also you can enter the competition to win it there.
And thanks, Louise, again, for sponsoring this podcast. The news this month is kind of quiet on the pom-pom front, apart from, wait a minute, is that the new issue?
Oh boy! So issue 17 is very nearly out and about, and if you're a subscriber, very nearly winging its way to you. Issue 17, our summer 2016 issue, which we shot, I think we talked about this last podcast, mm-hmm. was shot in beautiful Austin, Texas, where Megan lives. Shot in a pretty place called Redbud. I mean, pretty isn't really a strong enough word. It was absolutely glorious. Right by the water, and we're very excited because the previews may well be out by the time you're listening to this.
Should be. If not, check the show notes and there'll be a link, and if not, log on to Ravelry and everyone will be faving them anyway. You'll
exactly.
see them soon.
And as it's a summer, you know, I think summer knitting, I mean, I feel like it's good and present and definitely a real thing. It's mm-hmm. the part of knitting that is most confusing to non-knitters, I think.
Yeah.
But we have lots of really gorgeous tops and a shawl and a really cool bag made of rope. What?
Check it out, guys.
So definitely check all of that out. In fact, quick, do it now.
Do it now.
Pause the podcast, check out the previews, and then come back and listen to the following part of the podcast.
So next we have reviews. So at the beginning of the podcast, we mentioned we're talking to Rachel Atkinson, who started her own yarn brand now. Would you say yarn brand? Line?
Selection? I don't know, I guess. Well, luckily, so we're going to do this little mini review now, and then we get to actually talk to her. So, but anyway, we're holding a skein of the yarn right now.
Can you hear it?
Can you hear it? Cool.
Oh, sheepy. One of the nicest things, well, there's many nice things about this yarn, is the smell. It is a true, what we like to call, woolly wool.
It certainly is. It does smell of lambs and fields and hay. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Grass.
Sweet grass and hay and sheeps.
It does. And it smells of delightful knitting. So it's, I mean, we won't talk too much about this because we're going to be able to actually talk to Rachel about it very soon. But to give you guys just a little idea, it's a double knit. And it is yarn from Hebridean sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And it was clipped on the 23rd of July, 2015.
So one of the nice things about this yarn is that it's so Britain-centric. Mm-hmm. You know, Rachel's taken a lot of time to source all the processes of this yarn to keep it local. The yarn hasn't been dyed, and I think that's part of the intrinsic quality of this yarn, the fact that it's all very naturally sourced. Mm-hmm. Rachel's kind of kept the natural look of it. So you got this nice soft brown, like a deep kind of treacly brown with soft little white flecks of the fleece
mm-hmm.
of the hairs. So that kind of gives it a soft halo. You know, you're not getting anything too rough with this, although one would expect like a pure sheep yarn, but it's got like a nice
it is
nice
softer than I thought
it
was
yeah.
going to be based on reading about it on her blog and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It is soft, you know, it's still got the kind of, you know, that it's sturdy. It's got that
yeah.
kind of structure of something that's, you know, a kind of British breed, you know, a hardy sheep
mm-hmm.
and something that hasn't been over-processed.
Yeah. And also there's a nice, when you're knitting with the yarn, there's a nice bounce to it. And like I said, this kind of soft halo kind of gives a little fuzz to the stitches. So
yeah.
it's a really nice, a yarn with like quite nice depth. You're not like a plain flat yarn to knit with. So
yeah, it certainly is. And I'm pretty sure at this point that it's actually sold out. So if you didn't
yeah.
manage to get any, then I'm sorry that we're just talking about a thing that you can't get. But you will soon be hearing more about the story of it. And I think, you know, a description of the yarn just helps that
segue.
Exactly. But yeah, so why not talk to Rachel herself about the creation of this lovely yarn?
Oh wait, we can.
Hey!
Here she is. So in a cozy corner of London, we are meeting with Rachel Atkinson, who is a long-term pom-pom friend. Also now has her own yarn range. We're going to be talking to Rachel about all the wonderful knitting things she does.
We are indeed. And we are in, just for a little more context, we're in Foyles, which is where the Christmas party was this year. We're just meters away from where the magic was happening. But yes, we have Rachel here, the more important part, who is daughter of a shepherd and tech editor extraordinaire and knitter. So hello.
Hello.
You were at the pom-pom party, weren't you?
I was at the pom-pom party, yeah. It was kind of a crazy whirlwind. In fact,
I didn't actually find the bar at any point. I kept trying to find the bar and then I just get stopped by somebody else and it's like, I'm never gonna get a drink. So I didn't.
So, well, you know, we're just promoting abstinence and
No, it was great. It was really great. It was, I had a lot of fun.
It is always a whirlwind, those kind of quick get-togethers of everyone doing all the like, hi. Yeah.
So we always start with how you came to be a knitter and how did you learn to knit?
I think like so many people, I was taught by my mum and my grandma when I was young, and my mum did a lot of knitting and a lot of sewing as well, and my grandma also knit baby clothes for us and crocheted as well, and mum crochets, and then I knitted through until I was about 13, knit quite a lot of mohair sweaters, well, mohair in the loosest sense in the world. Yeah.
A loose gauge would be.
Loose gauge as well. And then I kind of left it all behind when I was about 13 or 14 and picked it up again. So, almost 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
I was really ill and needed something to do, so mum brought me a ball of wool and some needles and I haven't stopped.
Wow, yeah, little did she know.
Really on her own. Yeah.
Alter the course of your life, pretty much.
Yeah, it did actually, yeah, completely.
I think, I guess for so many people we talk to, it's not like you go to uni to become a tech editor or indie dyer or, you know, hand-knitting pattern writer.
Yeah, you don't at all. And you don't... I was working at a bookshop and I was knitting on a lunch. Well, I was knitting at every possible opportunity, as you do. So I was knitting on the bus to work, and then when we had a break, I was knitting, and lunch I was knitting. I was knitting on the way home, knitting when I got home, knitting in bed, and I just couldn't stop. And then I started wondering if knitting could possibly be a job. Is it possible? And it turns out it is.
So what was the process? What was your next step? And after knitting all possible hours, you were like, how can I make more knitting available?
I think part of what I really loved about knitting was that I just could keep learning stuff. So you learn how to do your knits and your purls, and then you learn to do a cable, and then you learn to do colour work, and then you learn something else. And I kept learning so much, and then I started doing some test knitting for various designers. And from there, I started wondering if I could get into tech editing, which I'd been hearing about vaguely on Twitter. I was like, oh wow, there's this job that you can do that means you can knit and learn more about knitting. And from there, Jen Arnold Culliford, I did some work with her and she taught me a little bit. And then I just kind of fell into it. I guess I blagged it a little bit, as you have to do in these situations. And you sort of learn on the job. And if you don't know how to do something, then you go and find out how to do it.
Yeah.
And just kept reading and kept knitting, and it eventually became my full-time job.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And you're very good at it, might be.
Oh, thank you. It's quite stressful because it is quite stressful. And especially if there's mistakes and things, it's like the worst feeling in the world. But
yeah,
I really enjoy it.
You say that's the worst feeling in the world, but
yeah.
On the other side, what's the best part of it? What is it that draws you to it?
I really like sort of I won't be able to think of the word now, but taking something from scratch and working through it and editing through it and getting the final end product and then seeing it in print. Seeing how different designers work is really interesting.
Yeah.
That's every now and again you'll get a pattern come through and you'll be like, oh my goodness. Like, I think one of Bristol's pattern, her callus, I think it was one of the first patterns I'd had in a while that I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to change my life, kind of thing. And I sat down with some paper and I cut it out and I did like some origami style cut and pasting. And I was like, how has she even thought of this?
Yeah.
That is really, really It's sort of getting an insight into how people think is really interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
And that shrug really is a sort of engineering masterpiece.
Yeah, it is.
Like, that's why it's so exciting, and I can see why you were so excited when you started to look at the pattern properly.
Yeah, and it was, you can usually, with patterns, you can usually, without seeing the sample and without having to knit it, you can usually see it in your head how it's going to fit together. And with this, I just couldn't.
No.
I was like, does this go here? Yeah. And how does that get to here? And why is this doing this? And I cut out these little pieces from the schematic and I was trying to put them together. And anyway, it does. It works amazingly.
That's interesting you say you could, because do you think that's something, like when you first started tech editing, could you always see the knitting in your head, or is that something, because it sort of feels like when people say, people who are very good at music, for example, and they could read a score and hear the music, and that to me is like...
magic.
Yeah, like exactly like magic. And actually, to me, it sounds like magic to be able to, there are obviously some things I can see in my head when I read them, but obviously, is that something you've developed, or do you think it was something that just
It's definitely developed to a certain, the more you do, the more patterns you read, then the more you understand how certain ones work. But yeah, that, I think being able to visualise something that's written in words into a 3D object, I'm from an arts background anyway, and I did quite a lot of sculpture, and I studied fashion as well, so I've always gone from paper to into 3D, so I do have that, my mind does think like that, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny the bits of your past life that become part of your knitting life.
Oh my God. It really is, it's crazy actually.
So yeah, maybe you could tell us about that, what's been your creative journey then?
I went from... I'd always wanted to be a fashion designer, like ever since I was, not since I was really tiny, tiny, but probably since I was about 7 or 8, and that's all I wanted to do. And my mum and dad were both in the rag trade, and my dad used to sell ladies' clothes as well, and so there was always kind of a lot of fashion around, and I just used to sit and draw dresses. Oh, that's all I did, was draw dresses. And nobody could have taught me out of not going to St. Martin's. All I wanted to do was, I want to go to Central St. Martin's and I want to be a fashion designer. And I got there and I did it, and it was a massive disappointment. And I left at the end of my degree with, like, qualified in not a lot. And kind of lost my way a bit and went into retail. Left fashion behind completely. Got into bookselling, wandered into that because reading's always been a huge part of my life. And I was really, really wanted to become a illustrated children's book editor, is what I really wanted to do. And I just couldn't get a break, into it. And from there, I drifted into the knitting, and then it's kind of strange how it's come full circle, because I've gone back to fashion, and I've gone back to books and brought them all together. So you never quite know where it's...
all the pieces have kind of fitted together in a weird way.
Yeah, it's kind of strange, but I'd have never thought I'd go back to do it to working with clothes.
Well, now you're working with the actual element, you're working with yarn. So
very true. Yes,
we can
very
talk
true.
About your yarn label, Daughter of a
Shepherd. Oh, segue.
Sophie is the mistress, I was going to say the master of segues, but we'll give her proper title.
So yeah, tell us about growing up as a daughter of a shepherd.
It was kind of bonkers.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's always it was always chaos. There was always at least, oh, I don't know, dogs in the back garden, a random sheep.
More than one random sheep, I'm sure. Like.
Yeah, at times. At times there was like a whole flock in the back garden if they'd escaped from somewhere, which they did quite often. So they'd escape at any opportunity they could. That is basically a sheep's objective, so I can guarantee, like, if mum and dad were getting ready to go out on a Saturday night, you'd get a phone call, John the sheep are out. And off they go. And Christmas morning, I remember him going and getting some out of them. I think they'd fallen in a stream or something. And he texted last week as well, and he's they've got three lambs in the kitchen at the moment. So,
like orphan lambs.
Yeah, orphans. So, it's never a dull moment.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, it was great fun. We spent pretty much every weekend out in the fields. Travelled quite a lot of the country, doing dog trials and markets and things like that. And
wow,
I can see. Yeah, and we didn't live on a farm. We didn't live on a farm, or we were on a housing estate, in a small new build housing estate in a village in North Yorkshire. So the sheep were grazed wherever they could, wherever they could get land.
So your dad raised them for meat rather than wool.
I don't actually know what he was doing. I don't know where they went.
Yeah. It was like lost over as a young child, you know.
Well, no, because we used to. He did this really cruel thing of. I don't know if you want to include this. But every now and again we'd get to the end of a Sunday dinner and he'd be like, oh, Curly Whirly was a bit tough, or poor old Wooly, she didn't. She didn't taste too good.
Oh no!
So some did go to slaughter, but yeah. He was mainly using them to train dogs on.
Okay. Yeah.
So he had the border collies that he liked training, and he needed the sheep to train them on. So it was more about the dogs than the sheep, really.
Right. Okay.
But now it's about the wool, and it seems this has been a long time coming. It seems like it should have been like a logical conclusion that your dad has sheep and you like knitting, and then they've come together, but it's kind of been a long time coming. What was this sort of catalyst to start the project?
The main catalyst was his 2014 clip had gone to the British Wool Board to take in most fleeces around the country, and they'd got a check. I saw him last year and they'd got a check for 94 pence, which
for the whole thing.
For the whole
thing. And how much wool are we talking about?
Like? So we're talking about 400 fleeces.
Wow.
So it was 90. They got 94 pence, and that was going to be 10% of the final total that they'd receive for the fleeces. So in total, they would get £9.40.
Yeah.
I think it worked out at around 3 pence a fleece. And so he was like, "There's no point in us doing this." So the 2015 clip was just sitting in a building. And they were using it around. He shepherds for the Eskrick Park estate just outside York, and they were using the fleece around the estate to protect trees and any other uses that they might have. And I was just like, I'm a knitter, like you say, I was a knitter, there's wool, it has to be worth more than this, it has to be. And just, it was just such a shame to see this amazing fleece that's, it's a really, really dark brown, the Hebridean sheep. And I went to Gotland to visit a friend as well, and they have, like, you can buy ready spun wool in the farm shops next to where the sheep are grazing. And I was like, why don't we do this? And I went home and I spoke to Dad at Yarndale, and then spoke to John Arbon, and we did it.
And the rest is history. The rest is history. Yeah.
It's been a bit of a more longer, complicated process. Yeah.
Got there in the end.
What did your dad think about all this?
He's like a man of few words. So I had a well done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Oh, I think I had a wow at one point as well. Yeah. Yeah. So no, he's really pleased with how it's turned out.
So the process from, so you got the fleeces and they went over to John and Juliet, their mill in Devon. And then you said, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, and you said that you had no idea what the wool would be like before it arrived. And then when it did arrive, how did you feel then when you opened the boxes?
Oh my God. So yeah, I had no clue what it was going to be like. And I just burst into tears, basically. Oh. Like, it worked.
Yeah,
it worked. And then I did a little dance, and that was it.
And then started getting it ready to take it to Edinburgh.
And then it was like, oh my God, we've got so much work to do now. So, yeah, it was like a huge relief, and really exciting. And I hadn't even thought that people would buy it. I'd hope they would, or that we'd have a product to sell. And then I hadn't even thought that they were going to knit it, and that they'd get excited about, I'm going to do a pattern in it, and I'm going to do that. Which has been even more overwhelming. I guess I hadn't thought that far ahead.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow. 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 Wow
how would you classify the yarn and like your thoughts about it, like the texture and the colours? How would you describe it?
It's first of all, it's a lot dark. It came when it turned up. It's a lot darker than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be slightly more chocolatey brown, and it's actually a really dark sort of Guinness.
Yeah,
malty kind Guinness, of brown.
That's a good colour name, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Jules Woolenflower described it as Guinness. I was like, yes, that's what it is. That's the colour. and it's really soft as well, which was, I was almost like beyond jubilant about that.
I'm interested to know, is that how the original fleeces felt? Or were they quite,
they're quite coarse.
Yeah.
Full of lanolin, and the sheep live near, quite close to a main road as well, so they're quite dirty, and they also graze in woodland, so it's covered in a lot of plant matter as well, and so between the scourers and John Arbon at the mill, they've done a really amazing job sort of cleaning it and combing it and making it into this amazing.
Yeah, and the other thing I was saying earlier when we were talking about the wool was that you can actually name every single person who's been involved, which is just a really lovely idea in itself.
Yeah, that's been really important to me, and also to credit those people with their skills.
Yeah,
because like the scourers do an incredible job, and there's only two big scourers left in the country. And then obviously there's John doing his thing down at the mill, John and Juliet doing their spinning, which is an incredible
magic,
skill.
Basically.
Yeah, it's magic.
I mean, but then it's not, because it's like years and years of knowledge and work and what looks like magic to us.
So it's very much interesting in kind of preserving skills as well and supporting British manufacturing.
So we also have a couple more of our regular questions. We're casting you off onto a desert island. You can take all your needles with you.
Okay, any needles. Yeah. And my hooks.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're only allowed one yarn. In all the colours,
but
just the one base.
Okay.
So you know the score. What are you taking with you?
Taking my daughter of a shepherd yarn.
Yeah. Of course she is.
What else would it be?
It's true. Good.
That was a really easy question. Yeah.
All right. If you were an animal, what animal would you be? She's shaking her head.
I have no idea. You've had no idea how much I've been thinking about this either as well.
What sort of type of, like, a bird type animal?
No, or
like,
I didn't, well,
fish.
Or should we a waterborne animal?
We've cut out aquatic, maybe.
Not airborne, not aquatic. Land-based.
I honestly couldn't think. I started thinking a bear, and then I started thinking an owl, and then
that's
I started
nice.
Thinking
yeah.
But like a bear's quite cool, but then they hibernate all winter, so you miss out on all the knitting time.
So it's kind of like a woodlandy kind of
woodland.
What's the middle ground between a bear and an owl?
Yeah. I don't know.
God.
Some
sort of mythical creature.
Maybe you're happy being a human.
Maybe I am, actually. Yeah.
Maybe humans are the middle ground between owls and bears. And on that note. So, inconclusive, I'm sorry, listeners.
Sorry.
But anyone who knows Rachel Atkinson well, feel free to send in.
Yeah, do send your suggestions on a postcard. Yes.
I guess it just remains for us to say thank you, but also, if people want to look you up online, if they haven't already, where should they go?
You can find me, I blog at mylifeinknitwear.com, and the wool is available from daughterofashepherd.com.
Great. And what's your Instagram handle?
And you'll find me as knittingtastic on Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah.
And Ravelry.
Wonderful.
Brilliant.
Thank
you
very much.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Much to Rachel for taking the time to speak to us and learning all about your yarn. Thank you. So next section we've got is knitters you should know about. So within the knitting world, there's some pretty big names that you should know people to respect who are the knitting
gurus.
Gurus, yes, I like that.
So this month we have Gwen Matthewman.
Do you know who Gwen Matthewman is?
I'm relying on you, Sophie Scott, to tell me all about
her. Well, I think it's important that you should know about this knitter.
So she's a knitter I should know about.
Oh, definitely. Because she is the world record holder for speed knitting between 1980 and 2005.
Whoa.
She was unbeaten throughout this whole time.
25 years.
Yep. So she set the record in 1980 for knitting 111 stitches in a minute.
And that's a second.
Yeah, she was remained unbeaten for that whole time. So she set this record. There was like a little local competition. She was from a little town in Yorkshire, West Yorkshire. And there was a competition in the local wool shop in Leeds. And she went along and, you know, wiped the floor with everyone and then remained unbeaten.
That is very cool.
She passed away in 2014. And although her record has now been broken for speed knitting, mm-hmm. she remains the record holder for the most prolific knitter. So I have a little fact here from Woman's Weekly of 1969. In the year, she knitted 4,391 knitted items in the wool-shaped garments is what the phrase they're using.
Whoa.
So that's...
in 1 year?
In 1 year. So that was at least 84 cardigans, there's pairs of mittens, 25 ladies' jumpers, and one teddy. And this was double her output of the year before.
Whoa, I'm lucky if I make like 4 jumpers a year. She does 1,000 times more knitting than I do.
Yeah, she...
Holy hell.
She ended up touring the world, being interviewed on like various record-breaking shows. Like there used to be the show Record Breakers.
Oh, I love that show.
So she actually travelled to Japan because a Japanese scientist analysed her knitting technique because they thought she actually had machines hidden under her arms. She was there knitting so fast and they had to like analyse how she knitted.
I can't get over that she made over 4,000 things in a year. That's insane.
So have you seen The Shining? Slightly off topic now.
I actually haven't.
Okay. So
you know me, I'm bad at films.
So this actually links in because she knitted a jumper for Neil Armstrong. It was her own design and she knit it in 6 hours. Of a little Apollo rocket on a little blue jumper.
Of course.
And she got like a little letter from NASA. I was trying to find out like what happened to the jumper and I think, you know, NASA sent her a nice little letter saying thank you. But I don't think he wore it for any press photos. There seems to be no evidence he wore it in space either. So, but the design, a copy of it was worn by Danny Lloyd in the role of Danny Torrance in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. So you have actually probably seen that design already.
Whoa.
If you're a fan of that film.
So is that the sort of thing that might show up on your Instagram?
Yes,
thing?
That's a good one. I should recommend those guys. Yeah,
you should. Gosh, that's crazy.
So in another little interview, I really enjoyed looking about this lady, Gwen. Another interview, this was done in the 60s, this interview, but it's interesting the relevance it still has today, because she said knitting today is on the increase. You know, it's a popular thing, apparently. Mm-hmm. She denies it's a skill for old ladies, and apparently more and more young mothers in Britain are knitting their children's clothes for economy. And she says people are discovering that hands knits stay in shape and they last.
Well, we can endorse that.
It's not just for the old kids, you know.
No. Wow. Okay, so she knits, obviously, or knitted incredibly fast. Was she like a continental knitter? Did she do kind of Scottish under the arm technique?
Yeah, I found some footage of her knitting while she was on the show Record Breakers. And she has the very long metal pins and she sort of has it anchored under her right arm.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, is that like, is that called... Scottish knit? No.
Well, I associate that style of knitting with the north of England and Scotland, where people who knit like that can't use circular needles because the way that they do it. And I guess it's the same sort of like knitting belts would have done a similar job.
Yeah, you kind of have it anchored in one way. Mm-hmm. She was a thrower.
Okay.
But had it sort of anchored under her right hand, her right arm. So she kind of had that fixed there. And great speed. And apparently she went through about 500 pairs of needles because she said they always had to be sharp. She couldn't have a blunt needle. As soon as she'd blunted them working through them, they're out. And she had to keep up her quantities, you know.
I'd love to know how many pairs of needles she went through in the year of 4,000 things. Like, that just means I'll never blunt needles. You know, like, I'll never... Like, maybe in my lifetime I'll make 4,000 things.
Yeah. So the fastest knitter now is... Well, apparently the record was broken in 2006, which is Miriam Tegels of the Netherlands, mm-hmm. who knit 118 stitches in 1 minute. But yeah, Gwen Mathewson, she's still, well, I think it's a record within itself to be a record holder for that long for that record, if that makes 20, sense.
Yeah, 25 years holding a record. Is. And also, I suppose, I mean, 118 stitches is amazing. There's obviously more stitches, but it's not a huge jump, I suppose.
Yeah.
To be beat. But I mean, wow, it seems like she must have been kind of a character.
Yeah, there's a funny little interview which she put on, which is her husband talking after her death and sort of remembering her. And he's like, wool everywhere, just sacks of it in the house. Oh, just everywhere. And her son's talking about, yeah, there was needles everywhere. And he, when you sat down on the sofa, you just had to just give the cushion a pat, make sure there's nothing underneath it before you.
Oh, that's, I mean, as far as knitters you should know about go, this is the first one that I think I genuinely didn't know anything about.
As I didn't either. And it's spent quite a while on the Guinness World Records website. Do you want to know what the longest scarf ever
do
was?
Do I?
It was 4,565.46 metres.
Holy hell.
And the fastest time to knit a jumper, mm-hmm. I hear. So the process was timed when the wool was worn by a sheep to when it was worn by a human. It was 4 hours and 51 minutes and 14 seconds.
Wow.
This was a competition in Australia in the 2004 International Back-to-Back Wool Challenge.
Wow.
There we go. So, an issue you should know about, and now you guys hopefully know a little bit more about, is Gwen Mathewson. Good for her.
Yeah. And if you guys have any suggestions of knitters that we should know about, that you'd like us to talk about, the same applies. You can email us or catch up on the Ravelry forums.
All right, our final section is top three, talking about the top things that we love.
Yes, we like to just list sort of slightly arbitrary. I mean, is cheese arbitrary? No, it's very important.
Yeah, this leads to passionate debates on the Ravelry forums. And just as when we had our discussion about toast toppings, you guys were very enthusiastic. Also seems cheese is something that's close to people's hearts.
Yeah, so we did our top three cheeses last month. And as always, when it comes to these top threes, I'm already reorganizing and changing the three that I chose, but they are forever recorded for posterity and they are unchangeable. But you guys like all sorts of other cheeses that we didn't even think of.
Kilter Craft and Rachel Leely were talking about string cheese.
Yep, love those guys.
I remember the catchphrase, the advert in the 90s used to be real appealable cheese. Just good.
Okay, I don't think I've seen a cheese string for like 10 years. I didn't even know they still made them. Baby bells. I had a baby bell yesterday.
Kind of plastic cheese family, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, string cheese where you can kind of peel off all the separate bits and eat them. Genius.
Good stuff.
Less sophisticated, but you know.
Well, I mean, you know. Round Rabbit says that they like Gouda because it's Gouda.
Yes, cheese puns. Very good. We're going Ecky Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
We'll say you're pronouncing it like that. She says you need a cheddar, but you know, she agrees with that, but you definitely need a smoked cheese, but you can get smoked cheddar, so she says that's going to be a good option as
that
well.
That is a good option.
Very clever.
And I do like a smoked cheese, so you know, it's sort of like I become full of regret when people suggest things. I'm like, oh, I mean, what I really need is a top 10 to top 20 cheeses.
I'm just gonna sit and eat cheese and then and Clara H recommends each cheese with a fruit, and very sophisticated, but she's French, so I think she knows her cheese and she knows her pairings.
And she knows sophistication.
And speaking of Clara H, she recommended a top three for us, which she kind of called the Hall of Shame, like knitting projects that have gone wrong, but ultimately we've learned from them.
Rather than having our philosophical section in the top tip, we've got it here at the end. Something to leave you all musing upon.
So I was thinking about projects that have gone wrong. And most of them seem to be from all around the same period in my life when I was knitting, maybe like 2008, where I was just starting to think, yeah, I can make actual garment things. So I've given them each a title. So number three, floats. What are floats? So this is when I was knitting a small baby jumper for a cousin, and the middle of the jumper had like a little cat tiger face motif, and the rest of the jumpers went pretty smoothly. But I realise now I should have done intarsia, to do this cap and done like the outline in the face. But the back of it was so tight and puckered, so you ended up having this really distorted tiny cat face that was kind of all wrinkled in because the back of my knitting was so tight. So it was all right, but it looked a bit angry and kind of squashed. You know, kind of get the Persian cats that kind of squashy face. So that ultimately, I learned a lot about colour knitting, but it was sad. I think I actually gave it to a charity shop because I was a bit ashamed to give it as a gift. But someone will find it and love it somewhere, I'm sure.
That's true.
So that was something I learned something from.
Okay, good.
But, you know, it showed me I could do a jumper. Number two was one of the first garments I made for myself, which I've just named Bamboo Yarn. Yeah! So I actually posted a picture of this on Instagram recently because I found the pattern which it came from, which was like an article in a newspaper. It was like very easy go-to cardigan. I was like, yeah, I'll make that. And I made it. It was a bamboo yarn, you know, suspect already. Neon pink, like electric pink. And I wore it quite a lot, but it was just kind of a bit weird shape. I never knitted the button band on it, but still would wear it. Maybe if you guys are lucky, I'll try and see if I can find a photo of me wearing that so you can experience that. I mean, I think it just go to show I wasn't really thinking about yarn quality or
like how well shape. The yarn matches the pattern. Because bamboo yarn, great. Maybe not for a first cardigan.
Yeah, so I think it taught me a lot about thinking about an end process rather than just being like, yeah, yarn and knitting. Go! So I think it taught me that. And my number one disaster was...
Oh boy.
Gauge. What's gauge? So it was kind of... I actually went and found it on Ravelry. It was like a Jean Moss, who's like a, you know, well-renowned designer for like Rowan and stuff. And it was one of her... It was like an off-the-shoulder, kind of quite Audrey Hepburn 1950s little top. Like a big boat neck. And it had like a tiny bow. And it kind of went with the vintage look I was going for. And even when I began to knit it, I thought, this is looking small. I was like, oh, well, and carried on knitting and knitting and knitted it until the very last stitch when I tried it on. And I was like, yep, it's too small. So that was really, really upsetting.
Yeah.
And I kept it for a long time. The shop I worked in at the time, they sort of displayed it. So it kind of had a bit of a life. But that...
Did you give it to someone else so it could be worn or...?
Yeah, I gave it to the... Well, the shop had it for a while as a display thing. And I ended up having this many years ago now. But that taught me a lot, that if you think something's too small, it probably is.
Or at least, because now I've realised that, because sometimes things are too small, but it's just because they're not blocked yet. But you can put a lifeline in and block what you've done so far. Oh, you see,
I wasn't even on the radar of blocking, so that probably could have changed it as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, so kind of a little bit sad about all these things, but I suppose they're all part of the story, the journey of knitting.
Yeah, well, exactly. And now, you know, you learned those lessons. And the other thing is that when people tell you, oh, you've got to check your gauge, you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you screw up and you're like,
Is now when I say check the gauge, like, no, I can tell you that you have to.
Come on, you actually need to do this. Well.
Oof, so I've learned, I've come far from these guys, you know, this is deep.
Right. It is.
What about you?
So, I have the list in my head. Because I didn't write it down. So at number three, I have the first jumper I ever made, which was for my then boyfriend. This is many years ago when I first started knitting. And I think all I'd made so far was like literally scarves. And so I got the yarn. It was nice yarn. I've still got it because the jumper failed. It's nice sort of Debbie Bliss tweed. And the problem was, so I made it, but I picked up the stitches for it. So it was like a seamless, you know, bottom up and then split for front and back. It was a very simple jumper. But the place where I went wrong was picking up the stitches around the armhole. I did far too tight and not enough stitches. I don't know how I managed this because I'm sure I was following the pattern, but I just did it wrong. You know, knit both sleeves. He goes to try it on. And it, like, he could get it on, but it was, like, he couldn't move his arms.
Little T-Rex style.
Just like, and now you have to stand with your arms out. Which, of course, wasn't the desired result of a jumper. So I took the jumper back and was going to, you know, rip it back and redo it. But I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And I think now I would do that, because also, I mean, it was very thick yarn. It wouldn't have taken me that long. But it was just the feeling of like, oh. And I think I didn't at that point really realise that, you know, it's quite often that I do still have to do things like that. You know, I finish something, or I get close to finishing something, and I realise that, oh no, that's not quite right. Either because I've done it wrong, or just because it happens that, you know, my shoulders are broader than the design, you know, all these sorts of things. And so now I'm pretty sure I would just go back and change it. But I think then the feeling of disaster was so strong. I was like, but I finished it. It was finished. And it wasn't actually finished at all. Well, it was finished, but it didn't fit.
I think we talked a little bit about this when we were saying a couple of podcasts ago, when you're saying, oh, if it's wrong and you know it's wrong, should you go back and fix it? Mm. And we think, you know, I think we always said, like, yes, you should. And I think it's having these mistakes, then you have the confidence later to go back and fix it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. What was the second one?
So number two was, and I think we even talked about this fairly recently. It was a jumper that I made most of, actually. And the thing that went wrong was entirely my fault, actually. It was that I made lots of this pretty jumper and then just lost the pattern.
Oh, no.
And rather than trying to just find the pattern again or buy it again, I just was like, oh, I'll just sort of make it up.
What point were you at in the pattern?
I was like splitting for the front and back, and I sort of felt like I'd memorized it. But then, of course, you know, with cables and their shaping, and I wasn't nearly experienced enough at that point to do something like that just on my lonesome. And I ended up sort of ruining what was a really nice project and just sort of losing interest in it, because I felt like it had become a disaster, like that other jumper. And I could have just ripped back to where I knew that the pattern was correct, bought the pattern again, or just actually found it. I think it might have been out of print temporarily, and that was the problem. But anyway, that was like, I don't know what I learned from that, though. I feel like there should be a moral to that story. It's just one of my main sad, like, knitting sort of like incomplete projects that I feel sad about, rather than an actual learning experience. I don't know.
Maybe it's that you know to move forward from the things.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, yeah. That, you know, and that I did have to just completely abandon that project eventually. I ripped it out, and I now have that wool. So it lives on in wool form. So number one is actually a bit more recent than the other two, but still a good few years ago. And it's about matching yarns correctly to patterns.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I made a pair of fingerless gloves for a good friend of mine as a gift. And it wasn't a hugely complicated, you know, it was just a nice little thing, you know, sort of plain, fairly plain pair of fingerless gloves in a very beautiful yarn that was fun colours that I knew that she would like. And so I chose the yarn based on colour alone and thickness, I guess. But I just didn't think about how hard wearing it would be, because, especially because I know that she cycles. And I still know from my own experience that cycling really puts a lot of wear.
Kind of eats up the wool almost.
It really does. So like, if you're, and it's like, you don't feel like you're sort of, like,
it's that little bit of friction of moving your hands from brake to like stuff.
Yeah, there's something about it that just really wears out gloves quite fast. And I guess also because you get sort of little calluses on your hands. Mm. So it's clear that there's some kind of wear and tear happening there. But basically the yarn was way too soft. It was, you know, a lovely four ply that was meant for sort of shawls and maybe hats kind of thing. Something that's not going to take that kind of wear. Anyway, she wore them like three times and they got holes in them. And I was kind of annoyed with her. I was like, I can't believe you ruined these. So I took them back to fix them. But then I just realised that I hadn't really thought about their final end game purpose. Mm-hmm. I'd thought about the colour. And that was kind of it. That's as far as I'd got. So I definitely learned from that, that it's not only important to match thickness, because that was sort of the main thing that I often, you know, get the gauge right. I'd sort of got that down by that point, but hadn't really thought about how well that yarn, it was like a gorgeous yarn. There was nothing wrong with the yarn. What was wrong was my matching of yarn and use. And so I took from that where, you know, use something hard wearing if somebody's going to be cycling the hell out of some gloves.
Well, there we go. We've made these mistakes, so hopefully you guys don't have to. But there's probably situations which you've experienced the same. So you can come to the Ravelry Forum and come and share and, yeah, we can all learn from each other, these mistakes that do happen. I think that was a nice suggestion.
Yeah, thank you.
Got me thinking, rather than us being, you know, I think it's refreshing sometimes, rather than us being like, yeah, the ending is great and we finished all the things. You have the other side, which we can all to relate to, you know.
Yeah, so that was our Hall of Shame.
Yep, kind of ending on a thoughtful, slightly melancholy note here.
Yeah,
no?
A little bit of pondering for everyone, but I guess we can sort of say thank you, as we always do, to everybody who contributed via the Ravelry forums and who sent us lovely emails. We're podcast@pompommag.com. And don't forget to check out the previews. Thank you to Rachel Atkinson.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you like this podcast, why not let the iTunes know?
Yes, so leave us a little review, little 5-star review, maybe.
Maybe, we can't suggest, but maybe. And that would be really nice. And you can also subscribe and all those kind of things.
Yeah, so come say hi.
We'll see you next month. We love you.
Bye! Bye. Pomcast is produced by Lydia Gluck and Sophie Scott, with lots of help from Eli Block, who created the original music for this show. For more Eli-related music, go to goodgirlandthebadtimes.com. Thanks as always to Megan Fernandez, the co-creator and editor of Pom Pom Quarterly, and to Amy Collins, our associate editor, who does lots of work behind the scenes and is delightful.
Thank you to Rachel Atkinson, our interviewee, and to Inspiration Knits, who sponsored this podcast.
Thanks, of course, to all you podcast listeners, all you Pom Pom Quarterly buyers, and subscribers to both of those things.
Send any feedback or thoughts to podcast@pompommag.com. And don't forget to join the Ravelry Forum on the Pom Pom group.